Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to welcome you to the PECO Holdings 2016 Annual Shareholders Meeting. This meeting was noticed to be held at 10:00 A.M. local time today. It is now 10:00 A.M., therefore, I now call the meeting to order. I am Raymond Marino, Chairman of the Board of Directors for PECO Holdings, Inc., and declare that the meeting will now officially come to order. Thank you for participating in our annual shareholder meeting being held today in person at the Museum of Contemporary Art, San Diego, and via webcast. After the formal part of our meeting, John Hart, our President and Chief Executive Officer, on behalf of management and myself as a board representative, will be available to take your questions. Following the formal Q&A period, members of the board will remain for a little while to talk with you further. There are now five items of business on the agenda for the annual meeting: the election of directors, the advisory vote on executive compensation, the ratification of the appointment of the company's independent registered public accounting firm, a vote on reincorporating the company to Delaware, a vote to amend the company's amended and restated articles of incorporation to declassify the board of directors, and a vote on the authorization to adjourn the annual meeting. Correct that, there are six items. I will act as chairman of this meeting. Trish Polera, executive assistant for the company, will act as recording secretary of this meeting. I would like to take this opportunity to introduce directors, officers, and staff of the company who are present at the meeting. Please stand as I call your names. John Hart, President and Chief Executive Officer, and a director of the board. The following members are the members of the board of directors: Howard Brounstein, Carlos Campbell, Andrew Cates, Michael Machado, Daniel Silvers, Kenneth Slapica, Eric Sperrin. I'd like to introduce PECO's Executive Vice President, Chief Financial Officer, Treasurer, and Secretary, Max Webb. Our Vice President and Chief Accounting Officer, John Perry. Our executive assistant, who does a wonderful job for us, Trish Polera. And our outside legal counsel, Jason Kent with Cooley. There are other members of the Cooley firm here, and I apologize that one of them, I don't have their card, Mr. Wainwright Fishburne, if you don't mind standing. And Mr. Fishburne, would you please introduce your other associate with you? Thank you. The board of directors has appointed James J. Raitt, President of American Election Services, LLC, to serve as the independent inspector of the election for this meeting. Mr. Raitt's function is to decide upon the qualification of voters, accept their votes, and when balloting on all matters is completed, to tally the final votes. Many shareholders have already submitted their proxies by internet, telephone, or mail. All proxies will be voted as indicated. Mr. Raitt, would you please identify yourself? He's in the rear of the room. Today's annual meeting of shareholders is being conducted in accordance with United States Securities and Exchange Commission's full notice and access rules, which allow companies to furnish proxy materials to shareholders over the internet. On May 31st, 2016, we mailed to our shareholders a notice regarding availability of proxy materials for the shareholders meeting being held today. This notice contained instructions on how to access our proxy statement and our annual report to shareholders. The notice also contained instructions on how to vote online or by telephone and indicated instructions on how to receive a paper copy of the proxy materials by mail. I will now ask for the affidavit as to the notice for the meeting from the Inspector of Election. The Inspector of Election has filed and signed oath of, excuse me, the Inspector of Election has filed his signed oath of office. The list of common shareholders produced by CompuShare Trust Company N.A. will be kept open during this meeting and will be available for inspection by any common shareholder of the company. I will now call on the Inspector of Election, Mr. Ray, to, one, report on the number of shares of common stock outstanding, state the number of shares of common stock which are represented at this meeting in person or by proxy, and state whether the quorum is present. The report by the Inspector of Election indicates that a quorum is present and that we may proceed with the business of this meeting. The proposals to be voted on have been put forth and described in detail in the company's proxy statement. If you received a notice regarding the availability of proxy materials for the shareholder meeting being held today by mail, you did not receive a printed copy of the proxy materials unless you specifically requested a printed copy. The proxy materials described in the three methods by which you could vote your shares, one by internet, two by telephone, or three by mail. Mr. Raitt, the Inspector of the Election, has tabulated all proxies voted and has furnished a report to the recording secretary. If you have already sent in your proxy by internet, telephone, or mail and do not wish to change your vote, you do not need to do anything else at this time. Are there any shareholders present who have not sent in a proxy or voted online or by telephone, or have sent in a proxy or voted online or by telephone and desire to revoke it and vote in person with respect to any of the proposals? The time is now 10 minutes after 10, and the polls are now open. The first item in this in the election of the Class II directors, the Board of Directors set forth in the company's proxy statement the following nominees to serve as directors, each to serve until the annual meeting of shareholders in 2019 and until his or her respective successor is elected and qualified: Howard B. Brownstein, Kenneth J. Slapika. Under the company's bylaws, nominations are made in advance and must comply with the requirements described in the bylaws or in accordance with Regulation 14A under the United States Securities and Exchange Act of 1934. Accordingly, with no other advance nominations having been admitted by the shareholders of the company, the nominations for the election of the directors are now closed. The Board of Directors has recommended a vote for the election of each board's nominees to the Board of Directors. Are there any shareholders present? Please come in. Are there any shareholders present who have not had an opportunity to vote with respect to this matter? The polls with respect to this matter are hereby closed. I ask the Inspector of Elections to obtain the results of the voting on this item and to report to the meeting. Thank you. We'll have a Q&A period after the formal part of this discussion. Okay. Thank you. I declare Howard B. Brownstein as a Class II director nominee, elected to office. I declare Kenneth J. Sapieha as a Class II director nominee, elected to office. And we will expand further on any other questions regarding this matter in the Q&A portion of the meeting. The second item of business will be to vote on an advisory, non-binding resolution approving the compensation of the company's named executive officers as set forth in the company's proxy statement. The Dodd-Frank Act requires that our shareholders have the opportunity to cast an advisory, non-binding vote on executive compensation. This is commonly referred to as a say-on-pay vote. This is a non-binding advisory vote on the compensation of the company's named executive officers identified and disclosed in the executive compensation section of the company's proxy statement. The Board of Directors has recommended a for the say-on-pay proposal. Are there any shareholders present who have not had the opportunity to vote with respect to this matter? Polls with respect to this matter are hereby declared closed. I ask the Inspector of Election to obtain the results of the voting on this item and to report to the meeting. Thank you. I declare the resolution as set forth in the proxy statement approving the executive compensation not approved by the shareholders. The third item of business will be to vote on the ratification of the appointment of the Audit Committee of Deloitte & Touche LLP as the company's independent registered public accounting firm for the fiscal year ending December 31st, 2016. The Board of Directors has recommended a vote for the ratification of the appointment of Deloitte & Touche LLP as the company's independent registered public accounting firm for the year ending December 31st, 2016. Mr. Ryan Martin, representing Deloitte & Touche LLP, is present and available to answer appropriate questions after the adjournment of the formal part of this meeting. Mr. Martin, would you please stand and identify yourself? Thank you. Are there any shareholders present who have not had the opportunity to vote with respect to this matter? The polls with respect to this matter are hereby declared closed. I ask the Inspector of Election to obtain the results of the voting on this item and to report to the meeting. Thank you. I declare the appointment of Deloitte & Touche LLP to be ratified by the shareholders. The fourth item of business will be the ratification of the proposal for the reincorporation of the corporation from California to Delaware, as set forth in the proxy statement. The Board of Directors has recommended that the shareholders vote for the adoption of the reincorporation proposal. Are there any shareholders present who have not had the opportunity to vote with respect to this matter? The polls with respect to this matter are hereby declared closed. I ask the Inspector of Elections to obtain the results of the voting on this item and to report to the meeting. Thank you. I declare the proposal to reincorporate the corporation from California to Delaware to be not approved by the shareholders. The fifth item of business will be to vote on the amendment to our amended and restated articles of incorporation to eliminate the classification of the Board of Directors to require that all directors stand for election annually. The Board of Directors has recommended that the shareholders vote for the adoption of the amendment to our amended and restated articles of incorporation proposal. Are there any shareholders present who have not had the opportunity to vote with respect to this matter? The polls with respect to this matter are hereby declared closed. I ask the Inspector of Elections to obtain the results of the voting on this item and to report to the meeting. Thank you. I declare the shareholder proposal to eliminate the classification of the Board of Directors to be approved by the shareholders. We will now move on. The proposal number 6 did not garner enough votes, so we're not going to cover that item. It's been withdrawn. The time is now 10:17 a.m., and the polls are now closed, and the voting on all matters for this meeting are now concluded. All ballots will now be tabulated. Mr. Raitt, as the independent inspector of election for this annual meeting of shareholders, can you verify that the counting of the proxies has been completed? Correction, that's not correct. Thank you. The Inspector of Election will furnish to me a written report of the final vote count with respect to the matters voted on today, which shall be included in the minutes of the meeting and reported on Form 8K to be filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission. So at that time, everyone will have the ability to see the final vote. It'll be available when we file the 8K. Thank you. On behalf of the company, thank you again for your participation in our annual meeting of shareholders and continued support. There being no further business before the meeting, this meeting is now concluded. We will now proceed with the presentation by management, and following the presentation by management, a question and answer session. I please ask everybody to keep your questions until the Q&A period and allow the presentation to move forward smoothly so that we can then proceed and have as much time as possible for the Q&A period. Thank you.
Thank you, Ray. Dorothy, would you like to join me?
Sure.
This update is intended to be an update to the investor presentation we gave last November, where we have new information. You'll find that information included on our website as well. Moira, can you read the safe harbor statement, please? Thank you.
This presentation contains forward-looking statements made pursuant to the safe harbor provisions of the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995. Forward-looking statements often address current expected future business and financial performance, including the demand and pricing of PECO's real estate and water assets, and may contain words such as expect, anticipate, intend, plan, believe, speaks or will. All forward-looking statements, including in this presentation, are based on information available to PECO as of the date hereof, and PECO assumes no obligation to update any such forward-looking statements. Actual results could differ materially from those described in the forward-looking statements. Forward-looking statements involve risks and uncertainties, including but not limited to economic, competitive, and governmental factors outside of our control, that may cause our business, industry, strategy, or actual results to differ materially from the forward-looking statements. Factors that could cause or contribute to such differences include, but are not limited to, those discussed in detail under the heading Risk Factors in PICO's periodic report filed with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Thank you.
Thanks, Moira.
We're on slide four.
This is the section on the Vidler update. This is a new chart that wasn't available when we gave their presentation in November, and it's a compilation of a number of economic indicators that show both current economic activity but also the expected direction of activity going forward. What's important to note, and we've mentioned this several times, but this represents it graphically very nicely, if you look at where we are today relative to previous times of high growth, which were right before we entered a recession, the significant difference is, particularly the last peak, that was a time of very overheated activity. You had tremendous amount of home building activity. There was significant supply of housing. The economy was driven primarily by the gaming industry and mining and by housing development itself. If you roll forward to where we are today, we are just in the really early stages of the economic growth that's taking place in the Reno market and the Northern Nevada market in general. And the composition of that growth is very different today. Mining and gaming and home building are not playing a very significant part of that, as much as more of these STEM industries are all familiar with Tesla. But there's a number of other tech companies that are building facilities in this area. So we think this bodes extremely well for continued growth in this region, which obviously has a big impact on demand for our assets. Slide five, please. We're particularly concerned about the pace of growth in the housing sector, and you can see whether it's new home starts or new home closings, all the indications for housing are very positive. And as important, our inventories are getting extremely tight. Now, that's important because, if you recall, we've mentioned before that a good indication of the direction of the value of our water assets in this market are the prices of homes. And when you combine what you're seeing going on in the markets here with the previous chart, that's a very positive indicator for the direction of expansion for prices for our water assets and for near-term demand. Next slide, please.
So if you recall from the Investor Day conference, we talked about the EPIC report. 33 different types of individuals throughout Western Nevada came together and did a regional report on how the area in Northern Nevada was going to grow. And they had different types of scenarios within the report. They had a high scenario of growth and mid growth and a lower level of growth. And basically what these two charts are showing you, both in population and in, I believe that other one's job report, households, is that we're kind of on this lower level right now, but we feel such we're at the beginning of the comeback in northern Western Nevada that we're going to see it jump to that higher line. But what it does show you is we've got a lot of growth going on, and we're right on track with what was projected in the EPIC report.
Comment just anecdotally, since you live in the community, what you're seeing?
Well, we are seeing a lot more activity. We're seeing a lot more things that we look at as people that live there. There's a lot more traffic on the road. There's a lot of traffic early in the morning that wasn't there before. The Highway 80 corridor going out to the Tahoe-Reno Industrial Center, known as TRIC, is quite congested. A lot of people going to work out there. We're seeing a lot more home building going on than we have during the recession. We know that our local governments they're very busy. They're somewhat overwhelmed by all the new activity and all the planned unit developments coming in. So we are seeing a lot more activity in our part of the world.
Thanks, Dorothy. And I think that's a good point in terms of staffing. What happened during the recession, which Northern Nevada, it was particularly severe, is you had layoffs within the governmental offices, and right now they simply don't have the staffs to keep up with the level of development and applications, permitting, et cetera. They're working their way through that. They're using outside consultants. They're rehiring. But it is a transitional process that has delayed the pace of development, which has led in part to the severe shortages that you see and the declines in inventory. Next chart, please. If you recall, this is a chart that we presented at the Investor Day, and we have some updated information. Dorothy, would you like to go through this? Trish, can you raise it a little bit? Or?
So what this is, we have an independent UNR regional studies, the economic department, goes through every quarter and takes a look at what is going out in northern Nevada. Particularly, we want to look at the Reno-Dayton area, Lyon County area. So they go through and they compile all the projects that are going through the process. And what this first slide is of Reno. Now, what I want to remind you is this does not include any industrial and commercial demands. This is all just mostly residential demands. It does not include other projects that are not currently on our radar, like projects that might be going through a rezoning. So what this is showing us is, now you've taken my number. Can you come down?
Yeah,
oh, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so what this is showing you is that the projects that are being tracked through the UNR regional studies is about 21,000 units out there going through the process, and of which 7,600 acre feet is needed for. So basically that in the top bracket, there's a place called Silver Hills, and so I want you to remember Silver Hills for the next slide, and that says 680 units. And then the lower bracket, most of the ones in the upper bracket all have water for those projects during the process. So we talk to all these developers all the time. So this Silver Hills does not have any water. There's 680 units. And then in the lower bracket, everything in red does not have water. So that's how we get, when we add all that up, we get 7,600. So I'm ready for the next slide.
Can we go to the next slide?
Slide 8.
This is material that we did not have available previously, and this is compiled by Dorothy specifically reaching out to all the developers in our area and conducting an informal survey of where they were in their development process. And for those that aren't familiar with that, you go through preliminary permitting and ultimately to final permitting. And the developers are similar to how they take down their land. They do it in a series of rolling options. And they will not exercise the option unless it's about to expire unless they have their entitlements, because they don't want the risk. And it's the same with the water. And they've indicated this to us a number of times. They call Dorothy and Steve pretty regularly, but the question is, this is where I am in my process. Are you going to have water for me when I get there? And that's really the gating item in our ability to sell water. It's not a negotiation over price. It's where they are in their process in getting a final permit. And what we did is, through this survey that Dorothy conducted, we've gone through and they've given us estimates of where they think they are in that process, when they think they'll get the final permit. And you'll see the demand from this list exceeds the amount of water we have available.
Under the first 8,000 acre feet,
yeah.
But we do have an additional 5,000 acre feet at Fish Springs, so it takes some additional permitting. So the previous slide, when I talked about Silver Hills, that's area number one. So if you remember from the previous slide, it was 680 units. What this particular builder developer has decided to do, through a meeting with local representatives and the neighborhood groups out there, he feels he can double his density. So I felt that he would have been the first guy in. It probably would have happened late summer, early fall, to come in and sign a contract. In fact, he had a contract for water. But after meeting with local representatives, there really is a need in Reno for affordable housing. And so he is going to go in and try to increase his density. And so instead of having 680 units, he's going to try to come down, get in and get 1,300 units, which puts him out a year. But he will utilize twice the water, because what he was going to do with only the 680 units, he was still going to put a deed restriction on every lot so that every lot can only use that 0.362 acre foot per lot. But he's going to go back in and try to reduce the size of the lots. And I believe those lots were like half acre. And he's going to try to reduce them to about 6,000 square foot lots. So we're going to see this go a lot in the North Valleys. And I don't have a lot of that on this particular projection. I'm already seeing these small parcels of land go in for upzoning. So we're watching the process. I don't know if this particular developer will get approved. If he doesn't get approved, he's going to be back in the door and he's going to start those 680 units. But I, as John has indicated, I talk to each individual developer who has these properties or their representative, and they gave me an estimated time when they thought they would be in for water. But as John also said, and it's very true, is, well, I'll be in a year, but you give me a call if it starts coming down sooner. So they're very anxious because they remember the last time prior to the recession when we didn't have enough water. When we started building the pipeline, people had signed up for water and we ran out. We didn't have enough to continue the assignment. So they remember that time and they're very anxious about it.
And remember, the pricing at that time was between $40,000 and $45,000 an acre foot. That's why, if you recall the first chart, we're getting back to those levels of economic growth, but this is in the early stage. So we think that's a very positive indicator for where we might see pricing go for our water.
We did sell water at 45. We sold a little bit, but
right.
We sold water at 45.
And, of course, I'm sure all of you are very interested in the timing, but you'll see the demand is within the next 2 years for our entire inventory of water that currently is permitted for exportation. As Dorothy said, we have an additional 5,000 acre feet, but we would have to do additional permitting to allow that for exportation. This is all regarding the Fish Springs Ranch water. The next slide.
Slide 9.
Is the Dayton market.
So again, UNR goes out, regional studies, the economic department goes out once a quarter and gives us an update on what they're seeing. And let me add on to that, besides them going out, we go out and count. We actually look at what's being developed. They're a little slower. I'll let you know they're not. Those studies aren't quite as up to date as we think they are, but because we need a third party, this is the third party work. But I want you to know we track it individually in the office. We send people actually out into the field to keep track and count on what's going on out there. So what? And again, this does not include industrial and commercial demands. Can I go back to the slide previous, please? I forgot to add something on slide 8. What I want to add here is, remember, this doesn't include a lot of commercial and industrial water, and there is the airport in the area that's 1,700 acres, and I only included 200 acre feet of water, and that's Area 9, and there's 1,700 acres at the Reno-Stead Airport, and usually for planning purposes, you would plan an acre foot per acre, but I only gave it 200 acre feet because I thought that's the first amount of water that would come in the next couple of years, but there could be a large demand coming from that facility. So I just want to note that I'm only counting homes and not residential. I'm sorry, not industrial and commercial development. Okay, next
slide.
And
this is consistent with our experience prior to the recession, where when the market really starts heating up, we typically grossly underestimate the amount of demand and also the level that price can appreciate too. And this is probably the strongest growth we've seen in the market, certainly since the start of the recession.
Okay. So what we feel about the Dayton area, now we're in Dayton, Nevada, we feel, and I have a map to exhibit this on the following slide, is we feel that this area really won't get going until the highway is done from the Tahoe-Reno Center, which is where Trick and Switch and, I mean, where Tesla and Switch, these different companies are located that are bringing in all the workers, down to Highway 50. So that road just started in June of 2016, just broke ground last month. It's anticipated to be done by next December, maybe fall of 2017, depending how construction goes. We feel that that's when this area will really take off in growth. So in the Dayton area, again, this doesn't include any commercial industrial growth, water demands, and it does not include the demands for stagecoach. But what we have calculated there is this area will need approximately 6,700 acre feet, which is quite a bit, probably about 2,700 acre feet more than actually Vidler holds. So we feel that this area will have quite a greater demand than that number, and this area will be water short. Next slide. So the next slide is the map that is designating I'm going to step over here.
And this white line is where the USA Parkway, and it comes right into Highway 50. This is where all the development will occur for the workers to get on up, and truck drivers and everybody else will be taking this off of, I think, 38 minutes. And people. So what we're looking at here is right now, we have under option with the developers 700-acre feet, $1,000 an acre feet, this proposed development. We own this 950-acre ranch, which is we're going to look at getting it entitled, so it's ready to go for a developer, and we own all the water in the area. And so what you're going to see is this whole area start to develop when this USA Parkway is all laid out. So here's Highway 80. Up in the green up at the top, that's the north valley. So you can get an idea of the lay of the land.
Next slide.
So now we're in Arizona.
And the water credits.
Yes, and we have, as you know, we have water credits in Arizona. So.
Dorothy, I've been told we have to speak in the mic. We're not being recorded, and in case there are any conspiracy theorists out there,
okay.
We don't think we're trying to hide it.
All right. So when Arizona started to build the CAP, the Central Arizona Project, in the 80s, California said, whoa, don't build that project. There isn't going to be enough water. We've got the highest priority, which they do. Don't build that project. They were very much not in favor of Arizona building the Central Arizona Project. Arizona said, no, we recognize you've got the lowest priority, which is the best priority on the Colorado River, but we want to build the project. We want to put our water to use. Arizona wanted to build the project because California was using all their water, and they felt if they didn't build the project, that California would be able to continue to use their water and they would never get their Colorado share. So Arizona built the CAP knowing that shortages could occur in the future. I don't think anyone was betting that they would occur as soon as they did. In 2007, so Arizona was always the one who was going to have to take cuts. When there was not enough water on the Colorado, Arizona was going to have to take cuts. In 2007, Nevada wanted some ability to wheel their Virgin River water rights into Lake Mead. And it all came down to the law of the river. Those tributaries that hit the Colorado became the ownership of all the states. And Nevada, instead of building pipelines and moving stuff to treatment plants, they wanted to leave it in the river and get it into Lake Mead, leave it in the Virgin River and get it into Lake Mead in the treatment plant. So they all came together and they developed shortage criteria. I'm sorry. So what they did in the 2007 plan was Arizona agreed to take, when the Lake Mead hit 1075, they agreed to take 320,000 acre feet cut off their allotment. And Nevada agreed to share in the shortage in 2007 of 13,000 acre feet. Okay, so here we go. But what nobody, well, perhaps they realized, but nobody really wanted to talk about, was when the river was split up between the upper and lower basin states, it was over-allocated. They didn't account for, well, it was also divided up during a very wet period, and now we're in a very dry period, and it didn't account for losses in the system or evaporation. So what occurred is there really is a 1,000,002-acre-foot deficit in the lower basin states for Arizona, California, and Nevada. There's really 1.2 acre feet less than what was divided up. And who has to take that is Arizona. So Arizona's concern is pushing at California now. Hey, if Lake Mead gets down to 1045, the Secretary of Interior is going to interfere, and you're going to have to come to the table. So let's come to the table before the feds get involved. So what Arizona is proposing, this contingency plan for the lower basin states. Arizona is proposing that instead of just taking 320,000 acre feet of cut at 1075, they'll take an additional 192,000, which brings them to 500,000 acre feet less in their allotment. Nevada has agreed to an additional 8,000, and in return, California. California will agree to take 200,000 when it gets to 1045, even though they don't need to. Now, is that going to pass? I don't know. So each of these states have to take this to their governing bodies in state and then take it for federal legislation. So is this going to happen? I don't know. But I can tell you this. This morning, Lake Mead was at 1071.9. Now, shortage will be declared August 1st, because what they do is they look at the lake August 1st and decide where it's going to be through all the models, their hydrologic models, and they will make a declaration for where it will be January 1st, and that will indicate whether the system goes into shortage. They are proposing that perhaps they won't go into shortage this year, but they will go, and they have an over 50% chance they'll go in 2018. But we'll have to see come August 1st for 2017. So what happens here is there's the 2007 plan, there's the plan they are proposing, and then you see the totals for each state on the slide. So if you get down to 1025 and you add across what each state is giving up, it makes up the 1.2 million acre-foot deficit. So that's where they're trying to get. They're trying to make up this 1.2 million acre-foot deficit. And why I point this out is because what occurs, next slide, is that some of the different ways they categorize the CAP water goes away. And that is the excess and the ag pool will go away first. And excess is where that's the water that Arizona uses to bank for all the to make up for the assured water supply of existing development and for future development. So that's the first supply that's going to go away, which makes our credits more valuable. So the dotted line would be under the new plan. If it gets through, all the different pieces of legislation will need to go through, both in the local states and at the federal level. And then the solid line is if it does not, what happens to Arizona? So as you can see, Arizona feels if they don't get their new plan approach, then it's going to start to dip into the existing municipal supplies.
The next two slides are really just photographic of where we are in the levels. Now, this is, if you look at the date of this, March 2nd, and then go to the next slide, you can see just in that time period how much more the water's declined, and as Dorothy said, it's dropped below the 1070.
It's dropped another 3 feet since May.
Water in the west. Next slide. Even though we're obviously in the middle of doing the accounting for the end of the quarter, we do have some updates. These have to do with our overhead expenses and cost savings over the last year, approximately $2.3 million per annum. And that's accomplished mostly through contractions as we are reaping the benefits from the sale of North Star, and as TCP's become more fully independent, the amount of staffing requirements we have gone down accordingly. Going forward, we think we can realize another $1.5 million in savings, so that our total group overhead, which includes Vidler, would be approximately $9.5 million. And again, that's further reductions in staff as a result of the contraction in the business from the sale of North Star and with UCP. But also, we're able to rationalize our current space because we don't need nearly the amount of square footage we have. We've actually sent something to the landlord canceling our lease, and we're in negotiations with that landlord to either reduce the amount of space we have or to relocate. So in total, those are pretty significant reductions in our overhead in the past year and a half to 2 years. We don't have a slide on UCP, and again, because we've just completed the quarter and they're in the process of counting, they don't have any new news to report. But I thought you might like to hear some insights from our chairman, Ray Marino, recently had a chance to meet with the management at UCP and also to visit one of their more prominent projects, which is the East Garrison Project.
Dorothy and John, thank you for that. Very informative. I never thought I'd like to see good news about a drought. But as a shareholder, it is good news for Vidler, as consumer of water is not so good, particularly if you live here in the western U.S. With that being said, as John mentioned, the board is comprised now of five new members, and when this started, we wanted to come up with a plan to onboard the new members as quickly as possible, be as thorough as possible. Some of us were called upon to hit the ground running immediately. Howard Brownstein was asked to chair audit and has been doing a very good job. Eric Sperrin was asked to chair the strategy committee, and I was elected chairman. The other members, Andy Cates and Dan Silvers, have done an excellent job getting up to speed on the company, and I want to thank Carlos and Mike and Ken for being very receptive and welcoming and giving us the benefit of your knowledge and experience on the board these many past years. In addition, I want to thank management. It's not an easy situation to take on so many new board members. I was in John's role for the last 20 years of my career and ran two public companies, and I know what it's like to go through major board changes. It takes a lot of work while you're also trying to mind the store and run the company, particularly at a time when we're shifting strategies and embarking upon a new chapter in the company's operations and focus. So with that being said, we started this process off with, I gave us a target of 6 months to get fully up to speed, and we're just about there. We had our first face-to-face meeting in Carson City, and we asked the Vidler management team, two of which are here today, Dorothy and Steve, to give us a ground-level view of what's going on with Vidler and its operations. And we had a very, very productive meeting. I think we've learned a lot about water. I certainly have some experience in it, but not nearly what our Vidler management team has. Next month, we are inviting UCP in to do a face-to-face presentation with us. But in advance of that, as John said, I took the liberty of meeting with them last week. I met with Dustin, the CEO, and Jamie, the new CFO. We had lunch. We spent about 2 hours together. It was a very good meeting. As the major shareholder in UCP, obviously we're eager to see them continue their good news and growth and prosperity and profitability. They educated me about the history of UCP over and above, obviously, what John's already done. And I think we should be very pleased with that management team. I've participated in one board meeting at UCP. I plan in the future to participate in others. I also am scheduling a meeting with the chairman of the board of UCP to allow me to share our goals and objectives for our investment in UCP. Secondly, I also had the pleasure of meeting with Jim Fletcher. He is the division president for UCP in, I presume, the region is California. And this was at the East Garrison Project near Ford, the former Fort Ord, a decommissioned military base in Northern California near the renowned Monterey Peninsula where Pebble Beach is located. We had about a two-hour meeting. He gave me a very, very good look at the whole project. It is a very active project. It's going along very successfully. And it is a entry, it's made up of three primary target groups, entry-level home buyers, move-up home buyers, and what I would call empty nesters or downsize home buyers. They range in price from the mid-$300,000 range to the mid-$700,000 range. There's a variety of products that they're offering. The construction is very nice quality. They have obviously refined the process tremendously since the beginning of the project, and everything seems to be going very well. So it was a very, very productive, very useful, and very positive meeting for me. But we will drill down in a little bit more detail next month at our August board meeting with regards to UCP's current operations, the status of the refinancing of their debt that's maturing, and their future plans. So that concludes the formal presentation. Let me just outline for the Q&A process. We have a very, very good attendance here today. And for those of you on the webcast, there's a great many people here. We're going to elect to take questions first from the audience. I would like everyone here in attendance, since we're all shareholders, to be respectful of the other shareholders and allow the questions to be asked and allow us to answer. Because there may be multiple questions from various parties, I would like to, again, ask that each person allow other people to ask a question versus trying to ask several questions in rapid fire in successive order from one person. I will go around the audience. I will ask you your name. I will ask you who you are affiliated with. If you're an individual shareholder, please state so. If you're affiliated with an institutional investment group or fund management group, please tell us the name of that group. And then state your question, and then we will do our best to respond to you today. If we do not or cannot respond to you today, either because of SEC guidelines or we frankly just don't have the answer for you, I promise you I will personally call you back. In the spirit of what we're doing here today with the webcast, that is also going to continue at our quarterly meetings. And I have indicated to management that I will participate going forward in all quarterly shareholder calls regarding quarterly operations and our filings. So why don't we go ahead and kick off the Q&A. Give me a second to remove the microphone. Do I have a question from the audience? Okay, I'll start with the first hand that went up. Yes, sir. Hold on a second. Repeat your name for me.
John Waite.
John Waite, and you are
an
individual shareholder?
Yes.
Okay, John, go ahead. What's your question?
The question is, over the last 10 years, our shares have gone down 80%. Our book value is down 60%. The market is at an all-time high. Our shares are at an all-time low. Last October, John Hart said he was going to put $50 million into our stock. He was going to buy stock back and bought a share back. Now, if you really want to buy stock, don't fuss around with buying it in the open market. Make a tender offer for it. Have a Dutch auction. Bid around book value and see how many shareholders want to get out and let them out. Those that want to ride with Vidler and UCP, they'll stay. But to do nothing and tell the shareholders last October you're going to buy $50 million worth of stock and buy none, that's ridiculous.
Okay. Did everybody hear?
First of all, to clarify, the board makes a decision whether or not to buy back stock, and the board passed a resolution authorizing the company to buy back $50 million worth of stock. If you recall, our business plan is, as and when we monetize assets, it's our intention to return capital to shareholders. The key is as and when. At this time, if you look at our available cash balances, there is not a surplus that would allow us to buy back shares. But it is our intention, as we've stated numerous times, that as and when the capital becomes available, we will buy back shares. We haven't decided on how we will do that, whether it's through a Dutch tender offer or other means. And the authorization was to allow us to do that when we're in a position to do that.
Hold on one second.
You can lever up, borrow the money, and start buying back the stock. Money is cheap out there right now. Do something. This stock is going nowhere as Pico Holdings. Wall Street won't buy your shares. You don't earn any money.
We're going to do one question at a time per shareholder.
Okay.
I'll let John.
I was just going to there's ways to buy the stock back. When you're selling at a 50% discount to shareholder equity,
okay,
that's good value.
We will have John respond to that.
We continually review different means for being able to buy back shares, including consideration of debt. One has to take into account the risk that comes with, realize that we do not have businesses that have recurring cash flow. UCP is an independent public company.
But it is something, we understand what you're saying. That's why our business plan has been changed so that all capital will be returned to shareholders through either share buybacks or special dividends. So we agree with you at this time, whether through leverage or through equity, we don't have the means to put that in place at this time.
I just want to mirror John's comments. I mean, the bottom line is I would not be in favor of leveraging up the company at this time because we don't have the assets. We don't have the cash flow to support the leverage in order to buy back shares. It's It's a part of my agenda and my discussion with the chairman and the board of UCP to come up with strategies to help us monetize our asset and investment in UCP. That is definitely on my agenda. Mr. Shapiro, I believe you had a question. Do you still have a question? Okay, great. State your name and then.
Andrew Shapiro, representing Lawndale Capital Management. Under generally accepted accounting principles, you have to mark these assets down, and you've impaired them at the lower of cost or market. You don't get the opportunity to mark them up. With the comments that were made today, whereby with respect to our water rights in particular, management has said we typically underestimate various things, and I appreciate conservatism, but with the underestimating going on and the impairments that have been taken to the asset values, which from our perception, the assets really haven't been all that impaired. I'm just wondering why the board of directors, this isn't a question for Mr. Hart since he's the recipient of the compensation, but why the board of directors that granted this compensation in the new plan felt that book value, why did you feel book value, the written down impaired book value, was an appropriate metric for determining such a performance bonus for management, especially given the percentage emulates that of a hedge fund, and most hedge funds that have performance metrics usually have a high watermark, pardon the pun, that needs to be achieved before performance fees get paid.
So the question is of the board of directors with regards to the comp program. Okay. Five of us, as I said, were new. And the previous board, prior to my arrival, approved this comp plan. It was negotiated at arm's length with both parties having counsel. It was negotiated. I did not participate in those negotiations, nor am I aware of the specifics of the negotiations. I was made aware that the comp plan was finalized and approved by the board at the same time that Howard Brownstein and I were onboarded, and Eric Sperrin was just slightly before us and did participate, I believe, in one meeting prior to the vote being taken. But Mr. Silvers and Mr. Cates were not on the board either. It is, I think, at this point in time, the best thing for me to say is that we have heard what the shareholders have said today on the say on pay. That's abundantly clear. I can also state to you that you have a newly reconstituted board, and I think you should allow us time to make a determination on any next steps that we want to consider with regards to the management comp program. And that's really all I can say today. One second. As a courtesy, let me just see if there's any other question right now from the audience. Anyone else have a question? Hold on one second. You have to speak into the microphone.
Okay. I'm Carlos Campbell. I'm the chair of the comp committee, and there's been a lot of disinformation around compensation. I think in order to put things in context, it would be appropriate for the CEO to at least go back about 3 years, which he can do in a matter of, I'm not going to say seconds, and put this in context. The shareholders, I think, have been deceived about the way this evolved. And I think it's critical to have an understanding to go from, I'll just say, 2010 forward. And I think John can do that very quickly.
Thank you, Carlos. I think the misunderstanding is the formula, the construction of the bonus scheme. The company used an outside advisor to assist them in this, and what they're really focusing on is because we were replacing any and all equity compensation and any and all cash bonuses that existed previously with this new comp plan, what would be an appropriate amount that is similar to other companies, and in particular, if you viewed this as you would equity compensation. So when you go through the formula, it comes out to, and it's for the entire management group, about 4% of equity, which, as most of you would know, is pretty modest in terms of equity compensation for management team with most public companies. We have the added situation to manage with regard to our state of business plan that we're going to return all capital to shareholders, because if we continue on that path indefinitely, there won't be a company at some point. And that makes it more challenging in terms of managing your staff. But that was really the metric. It wasn't to try to match up to some hedge fund or something else. It was really in terms of total compensation, what is an appropriate mix when you look at other similar size companies, other similar functions, and it was really looking more at that equity component and how this translates to that 4%. And the formula was really a way to back in to get that number. It wasn't meant to emulate a hedge fund.
Niraj Gupta, GCI Partners. I'll come back to my core question, but just since we're on the topic, I think one of the other issues is that when you look at the Fish Springs project and the pipeline, the actual book value is understated because the loan, as I understand it, that was made, that $100 million loan that was made, for the purpose of construction of the pipeline, if I'm off on some of the factual details, I apologize, but that's not included in book. So if you look at our book value on the balance sheet, it's actually understated by that amount on top of the fact we've taken the write-downs. So you've got a situation where the book value of the company is, cost basis of the assets is significantly higher than what's actually reported on the balance sheet. So I think that's something else that should be considered when you think about reconstituting or reassessing the comp program. Thank you.
Is that a question or a statement?
Well, it's a statement, but
okay.
If you guys want to find out, it's fine. But I'll clarify that.
Okay.
I think some of the confusion is, and I'm sympathetic because I have this discussion with our accounting department on a regular basis. The difference between how you derive the book value and what led to the write-downs. And although, as an operator, I failed to understand how you could tell me it's worth less, given the constraints on supply, but from an accounting function, when you run models and you look at the ability to sell water at a point in time, there was no market. After the recession, prior to the recession, it was very rare for us to have a project more than 5 years generated IRRs north of 40%. After the recession, I think we made the comment in 2012 that we've seen an increase in activity in the water business. So someone asked me, well, what does that mean? And what I said is, well, we're actually getting phone calls now. That was it. So from an audit, look at that asset worth. What is your ability to monetize X amount of water within a certain period of time? That's what led to the write-downs. So there's a difference between intuitively we think the water is worth, long-term what we think it's water, what it's worth, but what it's worth at a point in time today. Those are the constraints you have to work. We can't
you have to have some guidelines. Otherwise, you just start, you get into this very slippery slope of, well, what is the number going to be, and how did you get at that number, and what's your justification for that number?
About the $100 million loan that he's referring to.
Well, that is accurately reflected on the books, and it shows what the interest rate is. So I'm a little bit perplexed about that. I mean, what it shows is that the amount of income that would be paid first to Vidler from that partnership, but that is reflected. We don't own more water because of the loan. The amount of water we own remains the same. What we are entitled to is a greater percentage of the income, which is accurately reflected in the books.
Sorry, just for the benefit of the webcast.
Sure.
No, I understand what you're saying. We're entitled to the we're entitled to recover all of those economics, right? And that's a structure that we appreciate as shareholders. I'm just saying, if you look, you know, at a moment in time, you just look right now at book. Your book doesn't include the cost of that loan. So if you look at the payment formula for how compensation is currently constructed for management in the context of the 20% above book, it doesn't capture that. I realize that we get paid out first, but the formula for payout for management doesn't tie the loose ends up one to one.
We're going to let Max Webb, our CFO, speak to that question.
Yeah, just a little bit of a clarification, Niraj. The cost is reflected in there. That was the actual dollars invested into the asset. I think you might be referring to the interest. That is not reflected, and as John said, that is in book. That is just the economic right to get more out of the asset as and when revenues are generated from water revenue.
That's
in the invested capital.
My,
yeah, that's okay.
Great. Thank you, Max. Okay. Get my exercise in today. Your name is...
Good morning. Mike Milby with Gate City Capital Management. Mr. Chairman, you talked about looking to monetize the stake in UCP. One of the concerns I had was with UCP currently trading below book value, that the team would be disincentivized to monetize the asset in and around the current level. Could you or the team talk about your approach and willingness to monetize UCP going forward? Thank you.
As we all know, UCP is a publicly traded company, and even though we're a majority shareholder, action we take needs to take into consideration all shareholders of UCP. So that's something that we have to be very sensitive to. With regards to the ability for us to, quote-unquote, force the hand of another public company to do something, that's strictly not possible in the context of not putting ourselves at risk for damaging the minority shareholders. It's our intent to work closely with UCP and find ways that we can mutually benefit from a future event. What that event may be could include a variety of things. It could be the sale, merger, a number of things. UCP has announced a small buyback, but it's very small because they're restricted by certain debt covenants about how much they can do. So it's very, very early in the process. I don't have a lot of specifics for you because I want to take the time to meet with the chairman and other board members at UCP and examine what alternatives and options we have. We're very, very pleased. I want to underscore we're pleased with the progress UCP is making. They're a regional player, and there are a lot of headwinds in the various markets for home builders. There's been some success stories, and there's been some less than success stories. But UCP is doing well right now, and I, congratulate them on their hard work, and it's starting to pay off. John, is there anything you want to add?
Well, I think what you want to bear in mind, Ben, you're correct about them selling at a discount to book value. Their peer group is selling at a similar discount. UCP might be selling at a slightly greater discount because of the liquidity discount, because of a can do or what PICO can do. Recall that UCP went public at $15 a share. Look at the difference in the organization today. When they went public, they had delivered less than 50 homes. I think it was 42 or 44. Last year, you look for you look at their runway where they have to support that growth. So I would say they're clearly a more valuable entity than they were when they went public at 15. What's the difference? It's the market. And what can make a significant difference in the valuation to all the shareholders of UCP is when we see that whole sector start getting valued closer to historical means. Now, we understand the timing issue, but remember, Genius is a bull market. This is a very, very difficult environment to try to do a deal, and this idea of forcing another public company to buy us, or even us shopping our block or even trying to parcel it off in the market. To do that, you would have to be willing to sustain a fairly significant discount on top of the current discount. So our focus is on supporting their operations so they continue to improve, so that they are an attractive asset, and hopefully with time there'll be a significant revaluation for that sector.
Mr. Shapiro, please be patient. There's one more shareholder back here that's asked a question.
Hi, Bob Rabati, Rabati and Company. It isn't a question, it's more of an observation. And an expression of the question on compensation in the CEO's compensation plan. Being on comp board committees myself and the separation, the responsibility of the comp committee to negotiate that, hire independent consultants, which you did, negotiate those transactions, of course, understand the dynamics of that. And it's a counterparty transaction with the management to therefore negotiate something that's fair and equitable for both the corporation and for the executive. It's disconcerting on my part to have the chairman of the compensation committee then defer to the CEO, who's the counterparty in the transaction, to explain the nature, the justification behind the transaction. You know, that's something that the board and the comp committee should understand, and they should be able to answer that question. To defer to the CEO is an odd relationship that is disconcerting in terms of how that negotiation actually happened. So I just wanted to make that observation quickly. Thank you.
For the record, I'm Carlos Campbell. I will respond to your question, and what I actually had in mind, and I think in some respects the CEO is a bit modest. And when I was talking about context, I think if we go back to 2014, we had 80% approval on the comp plan. Something that most people don't realize is that when Ron Langley left and he cashed in his shares, John Hart could have done the same thing, and I think he would have realized, I believe, about $30 million. I think that's an important thing for context. The other thing is that I've been on, I think, 12 public company boards. I think I've chaired about 8 comp committees. When I took over as chair, I made sure we brought in somebody I had no relationship with whatsoever. I had chaired a company, and we had used Pearl Meyer. I thought they did a fantastic job. I think that's important in the decision-making process. So we brought in an independent consultant, Compensia. To forward and have an equitable compensation plan. I advocated 3 things: transparency, equity, and accountability. The other reason I wanted the CEO to opine was this, and most people don't realize this. He offered over a year ago to exchange his cash compensation for stock, and the comp committee turned it down. I was the only one that was in favor of that. I think that's significant. The other thing is that he has an employment agreement, and he's locked in. So we had to deal with that. For over 2 years, I tried to get a succession plan. I was fought on that, okay? So we did not have any ever been the advocate for the CEO. I have managed the process. I respect him, and I think he's worth the money that he's paid. You can attack me on that, and I can defend that. The other thing I will tell you, in all of the boards I've served on, I have never, ever asked for compensation for myself. Never. I've never nominated myself for anything, okay? So I will stand on my record. And that's something else I want you to know, and I think this is important. I was selected by my fellow members of the NACD in 2011 as part of the directorship 100. And when that happened, I was blown away. I mean, there are tens of thousands. And I made a decision then to be the best director that I could be. I wanted to live up to that. And I have been, I would say, maligned through disinformation. John Hart is one of the best CEOs I've ever met. He's a stand-up guy. He's an honest guy. What I look for is ethics, and I look for performance. And any of you can talk to me, after this meeting, I'll give you my card. You can stand behind what we did. Realize a lot of people know what's happened in this company. You owned a company over $1 million when it was cash poor or cash short. So there's a lot going on. Context, to me, is important. Performance is important. And clarity is important. So you want to talk to me, we don't have to belabor the point here. I'll be available, okay? And I appreciate your providing an opportunity for some clarity in this discussion. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Carlo.
Carlos, maybe I misunderstood what you said, but in the process you did talk about Ron Langley selling his stock and receiving $30 million proceeds and indicated that John did not sell his stock, and therefore he incurred a loss on those shareholdings along with all other shareholders. And somehow you seem to mention that in the context of being part of the consideration associated with his compensation plan. And I don't see the fact that he was aligned with shareholders and lost money and therefore is in any way a consideration for the compensation plan.
I think you're reaching a conclusion that's different than the point that's trying to be made in all the numbers. There's a lot of misinformation. First of all, Ron Langley was never... They were compensated as a team. When we first started controlling people, the share price was below not $38. People who see that are looking at Citation, which we did a reverse merger, not PICO Holdings. What Carlos is referring to, when Ron Langley retired, he exercised options, and it was for $11 million, and he strongly advised me to do it as well. I chose not to, because I was concerned about the impact it would have on shareholders. I was saying, even though I knew the stock was grossly overvalued at the time. That's what Carlos is referring to, not that now I'm entitled to some sort of catch-up. That was my decision to make. Yes, I did go to the board and the comp committee a year and a half ago and offer to take all my compensation in stock. That was turned down. I did not lend the company $1 million, but I provided $5 million of liquidity to the company so that when we were in negotiations to sell North Star, we wouldn't be put at a disadvantage in those negotiations because of liquidity. This has all been disclosed. I did it by purchasing otherwise fairly illiquid stocks that the company had. I think he's talking more about my involvement with the company and how I've conducted myself as CEO of the company, not
in terms of how that factors into compensation. The compensation was derived with the assistance of third-party consultants. You have a number of very experienced people on the board. You may not like the result, but the process was very robust and very good, and it involves a negotiation between two parties. The company may not have got the compensation they wanted. I didn't get the compensation I wanted. That's what a negotiation is. And you have to look at, I've heard a lot of noise around this, and if you look at the things that people have issues with and what the potential dollar amount is, and it might be $2 to $4 million swing versus what the risk to the company is if we go a different path. I'm the CEO of Vidler Water Company. I always have been. I was the CEO of UCP. For better or worse, that's the structure we used. And I did not get compensated separately. The comp committee is aware of that. They take that into consideration. The comp committee, driven by Carlos Campbell, went out and met with all the divisional heads to get an assessment on their relationship with me, my role as the CEO, et cetera. All that was taken into account. So, again, you might be critical of the result, but the process was very good and very robust and very open.
Okay. This is best for the people on the webcast. We do not have any questions in queue. Continue. We have another, according to our agenda, we're going to adjourn at, we'll complete the Q&A at 11:30. The board will remain for 30 minutes. We have other business and other meetings to attend to. So I will take another question from Mr. Shapiro.
Thank you. When you presently in your majority role, subject to, I'm assuming it's some type of shareholder agreement that's set up at UCP. Presently, Max Webb and John serve as PECO's board representatives on that board. Are those two individuals designated to be the board members, or can new members of the PECO board, as our Mr. Chairman or elsewhere, can they place and or supplement our current representatives on the UC board?
I know that we're entitled to two seats on the UCP board, pursuant to our agreement. I don't believe the agreement identifies Mr. Hart or Mr. Webb as the only exclusive representatives from PECO. Is that correct, John? So that's correct. So this board could make a decision to appoint other folks to those two positions. Okay. Hold on a second. Let me come over, please.
Last year at this meeting, John told us that UCP was worth more than the $15 when it went public. He thought it was worth, at that time, $16. Currently sells for $8. It's probably got a book value of maybe $11. If this company is so valuable and the future looks so good, why don't you buy it back? You own 57% of it now. You could probably buy it back for about $50 million, $60 million. You could offer PECO shares and some cash to go along with it. And if you try to steal this company, somebody will jump in and outbid you. They'll trump your bid. So you can put it in play. UCP is not a standalone company. It's going nowhere on Wall Street.
For the record, just so I have your, it was John, right?
Yeah, John White. John White.
John White.
Okay.
I think that was a question from John White, an individual shareholder. So in our deliberations going forward with regards to UCP and all of our assets, I promise you we are going to look at all the options available to us and do what we think is in the best interest of all shareholders. At this time, I don't want to get into details about your specific question because I think it would be inappropriate until our board's had a time to look at all the strategies and have a discussion one-on-one with the folks at UCP. How many more do you have left?
I'll defer to anyone else's questions, but as long as there's time on the agenda, I have questions.
We have 3 minutes left.
Okay. So it was announced that the results of this meeting, although we don't have the preliminary tallies, which I would really have loved for you to provide us rather than having to wait for the final 8K tallies, that one of the directors did not receive, Mr. Slupica, did not receive a majority share vote and is declared elected onto the board. Can you please walk through now what the deliberations will be and the majority vote resignation policy of the board, and then how things will proceed with respect to the voting within the board, who's recused, how does that all work to determine whether or not that three-year term seat will be vacant, and then what you might anticipate the board doing with that vacancy, whether the board will shrink or whether you would be open to other independent nominees?
Multiple questions there. I didn't take notes, so I'll try. Hope my feeble memory will remember them all. The first question is very straightforward. With regards to the process, the company has a process. It's on the website and the corporate governance. Prepared for this question because you and I had spoken and you'd raised it once before, and I directed you to the website. So it's very clear, all the last page of that guideline and a little bit of the page states the process that the board has to follow, starting with the Nomination and Governance Committee. Those deliberations will start immediately once we get the certified vote, and we will begin those deliberations. We have up to 90 days for the company to respond with its decision. According to the guidelines, it will not take that long. And the Nomination Governance Committee will take into consideration all the factors outlined in the guidelines and any other relevant factors in making its determination. We will then make a recommendation to the board, and the board will then cast its vote on the course of action with regards to the specific director. You asked a question about the what we plan to do with if the decision. I won't comment on the deliberations because we haven't had them yet, so there's nothing to comment on. But with regards specifically that if the director, it's determined, should resign from the board, and that takes place, then the board will have a separate discussion about whether we want to leave the size of the board at its current size, absent that director, or replace that director. I can't comment on that right now because I respect the opinions and positions of the other fellow board members, and I want them to weigh in on that question, but we intend to address that as well. Did I answer all the questions?
Because of the inherent conflict of interest.
Yes, the guidelines specifically state in writing that party, in this case Mr. Slupica, cannot participate in any of the committee deliberations or board deliberations. He does have the right, though, to respond to questions from the committee or the board with regards to those deliberations, but the votes are taken without him being present. Does that answer your question? Okay. We have another question, and then I think this will be the last question because we're about a minute over our cutoff time.
My name is Matt Brand. I'm here for Ancora. My question is, I understand on UCP you can't talk about monetization because it's a public company. Vidler being private, could you please comment on any monetizations in that company?
So with regards to Vidler's monetizations, I think Dorothy accurately outlined what the marketplace is reflecting right now in the way of potential future demand. We typically won't comment on specific negotiations that are ongoing,
It's always been my practice as running two public companies, until you have a purchase and sale agreement signed, there is no deal. That's just sort of how I've operated. And I think John shares the same sentiment. But if there's anything else you want to add.
Well, I'm more conservative. Until you close, I don't really think you have a deal. But in terms of monetization of Vidler, everything's for sale. I mean, that's the business they're in, is developing assets for monetization. The pace of the monetization is a function of the market. And as I said, and the data seems to suggest, we should start seeing an increase in that pace. For instance, Fish Springs Ranch, the survey of the developers would suggest that they believe they'll be going to final permitting within the next 2 years, and they can't get that permit unless they have the water. And you saw the Lake Mead data. We are in ongoing discussions to sell water a number of different parties. So everything is on a monetization path, as it always has been. You would always consider a sale of the company. There's not a real market for it because it's such a specialty business. And remember, of all the different companies, both public and private, that have tried to enter this business, we're the only ones that have been consistently successful. And part of that would have to do with the team that Dorothy assembled. We don't rely as much on consultants as others do. That's one reason. Also, understanding the particulars of the business and what it takes to be successful. But when you think about who would buy this company, there aren't a lot of people that have deep expertise. This wouldn't be a very good bolt-on to other companies. Maybe a financial buyer, but they would need to buy it at such an extreme discount. And why would you do that, particularly in light of where you are in the market today? I mean, you might have had a different discussion in 2010, but seeing where you are in the market today, I mean, it's similar to East Garrison that UCP has. They're generating such higher margins selling the land as part of a finished home than if they were to wholesale that land, because a new developer, to make their margins, would have to buy it at such a significant discount. And that's why they're selling it through the sale of homes rather than a wholesale price. Fiddler's very similar.
Great. Thank you. So this is going to conclude the Q&A. The board will be here until noon, and then we have other meetings to go to this afternoon. We appreciate everyone's attendance. Again, the lines of communication are open. If you feel that you want to communicate with me, feel free to do so at any time. If you need my phone number, you can call the office and get it. Thank you again very much.